con el under $3 menu de McDonald's, un McChicken es solo $1.50. Resulta que ser el héroe de tu primita solo te cuesta $1.50. Por un McChicken, good deal. Solo por tiempo limitado. Precios y participación pueden variar. Precios con entrega pueden ser más altos.
Hi and welcome to Season 2 of Good for Construction. In Season 2, we talk to people who've studied architecture but have ventured into creating and choosing a different field as a profession. Through the conversations with our guests in Season 2, we track their career trajectories and see the paths that they've chosen and how they've landed up in the career and the profession that they have right now. Before we begin, we'd like to let you know that our podcast is available on a bunch of platforms like Spotify, iTunes, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, and Castbox. You can download any of these applications from the Google Play Store or App Store. Subscribe to our channel on any of these podcast applications to stay updated. Also, follow us on social media platforms like Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter for behind-the-scenes updates and pictures. Our handle is at Good for Construction Podcast. Today in studio, we have Shears. Hi, Shears. Welcome to the studio.
Hi, Isha. I'm happy to be here. It's been a nice morning. Yeah, looking forward to this talk.
Shears, let's talk about what you do, what your profession is all about, to give the listeners a little context.
So I've been working as a researcher with the Indian School of Design and Innovation, Parsons, where I focus more on the understanding of materials and how human relationships with the space respond to materiality of things around us. I specifically look into material innovation, where we look at developing new materials, either which are biodegradable or they follow cradle to cradle approach, where you can assemble them easily and dismantle them easily. Materials which are healthy, so you don't have ill effects or a negative relationship with the environment or the interior, and being more conscious about what is the entire life of the space, the materials. So everything around us is made up of matter. And I specifically focus on innovation in materials, and then, of course, followed by systemic changes to create a sustainable future.
Yeah, how many institutes in India would be doing something like this?
I'm not sure about a deeper understanding of materials into this, core. I think we have in ISDI, India's first material library, which is in collaboration with the Material Connection New York. They have around 4,500 smart materials, in their archive.
Wow.
So a team of engineers, scientists, material designers, conceptualizers work together. So what we have done is we are working with them to, sort of curate a material library. And we have around 126 in our own space. This point onwards, we are looking to develop a platform for having conversations on sustainable futures through the lens of materials and through lens of systems.
Okay.
So this becomes in ISDI the place for all kinds of development of thought and practice-based researches.
And how much of these 126 out of the material? 126, right?
We have 126 right now to ignite the thoughts.
Yeah.
So
how much is it? Do you also think of taking it commercially? Is that also included in material research, or does it go to a different place altogether?
It's a development, step-by-step development. Right now, we have some materials that can be directly applied into a commercial space. Some are really innovative. They're ultra-light, ultra-strong, and that's why ultra-expensive.
Like
carbon fibers, which is the future of, construction. They're going to be replacing steel.
Yeah.
But they're not they're not easily available in India and for an affordable price. Similarly, we also have materials which are made from mushrooms or have a natural source.
Really?
Yes.
Mushrooms?
So, yeah, the root of mushrooms is a very potent, source for developing materials. All you need to do is get some mushrooms, put them in a dark room for 7 days, give it agricultural waste as food, and you get a material that can be a building block for construction, or it can be a furniture.
You use it as a reinforcement?
It's a mass in its own. It's a physical mass. So similar to a piece of sponge, but a solid one. And that's biodegradable. It's, it's a healthy material, doesn't have toxic emissions.
Yeah.
So these materials are a little hard to directly apply because in the external environment, we have a lot of forces of nature, to be considered.
Yes, yes. That was my question that, when you use biodegradable material, isn't the wear and tear speed and pace of wear and tear, isn't it faster?
It is faster, but we can always be mindful of and be very contextual about what we are designing, you know. For example, most of the materials today, if they're synthetic, they are designed to last for way longer than the actual use.
Yes.
Like, we don't inherit toothbrush from our parents,
But
still they are made to last for 12 generations.
Yeah.
So, there's a comparison of a life of a material and a use of material, and biodegradable materials, even if they last a little, small for a shorter period, we can contextually use them where architecture or spaces or products are made to be, renewed. You know, we can live in that world instead of... Because when we design materials that last for generations, we create a lot of waste.
That's true, but I feel like the perspective, and this I think is not really addressed in any architecture school per se, that you design to what? You design to create a monument, an edifice, structure that lasts forever, or do you design to suffice the use of one or two generations and then you're done? I feel like this perspective is not really taken into consideration, and that's why a lot of people don't maybe think the way you do, because they don't see it as material life or, you know, waste being created. They see it as creating structures that will last forever and ever, and you know, they want to design that way. So do you think that is something that architecture schools should address?
They must. Now, I'll just give a little insight on what you just mentioned. Yeah. Majority of the industry is pressured by standardization.
Yes.
When we standardize, we can manage the cost of production and installation, and also perhaps demolition. But not necessarily we have in that process, we have capacity to think of the big picture of what's going to be the future. Sorry, what was your question again?
My question was that do you think it's important for architects to address what we build for and how long we build it for, whatever it is, whatever kind of space you're creating?
Yes, it's an important question. The life of a building, the life of the user, the life of the environment around it, they all need to be in sync, of course, taking into consideration the material itself. But every architecture school has their own priorities. It's easy to stand out and, you know, say and comment on what's working and what's not, but because I'm working with a school, I understand challenges of developing a curriculum.
And also you teach.
So
you're talking from both the... Actually, you're in a great position right now, because you are imparting education and you're even, you know, kind of altering it to make it better. So that's...
And it's a team effort. I mean, I've been working with our program director in interior design, Meenal Sutaria. She's also the founder and director of Green Angle, which is a sustainable design company, a consultancy company. She and I have been developing this ethos in the school where we can develop ideas and call in a lot of designers, artisans, manufacturers to work together and debate on what architecture should be in India.
But don't you think the approach now should be a little more aggressive? Because given the level of climate change that we have arrived at, don't you think that, I mean, sure, countries are pledging left, right, and center and saying and giving like absurd, you know, declarations, making absurd declarations. But I feel like it starts really with, I mean, and building construction is one of the largest contributors to climate change and the carbon footprint.
Absolutely.
Right? So don't you think, as a teacher, as someone who is imparting education at a very impressionable stage, I feel, like college first year, college second year, it's quite impressionable. And if you're convinced and if you are informed enough as to what the implications are of what your profession is doing, then I feel like the future of architects can be driven in the right direction, I feel.
The future is now, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
I think the coming 20 years are going to be the most critical to make it or break it into the future of societies. You know, we have limited resources. Once the resources get extinct or they get exhausted, our cost of living is going to be exuberantly high. The value of life is going to be exuberantly low. You know, and if we don't make those changes in our systems today, we will have a very difficult future.
So, Shiz, for everyone to understand, our listeners to understand what your career trajectory has been, could you map it out very objectively for us?
Yes. So I wanted to be an automobile designer. initially, which moved to being a yacht designer. Aspirations. But yes, somewhere design and engineering was always rooted in my mind, in my brain.
Okay. Was it from school or is it like an effect of the family?
I'm not sure. Intuitively, I guess. But I ended up in architecture as an accident. I didn't want to initially. But when I spent my first week or first 2 weeks in school, I felt it was the right place. And
Of course, it was the right place. You were in JJ.
No, I was in Goa School of Architecture for my first year.
And then
I moved to JJ in second.
Yeah.
So that's when I realized that, yes, architecture is an interesting field. I get to apply my design interests. It also satisfied my engineering or scientific brain in a way. Of course, back then I had little understanding or this holistic picture wasn't clear until I worked in Mumbai for 2 years and I moved to Barcelona for my master. That's where all the definitions of what architecture is were broken. They were completely shaken up. For example, initially, you know, we were trained to be very to design based on function and based on user needs. And the traditional education in India, you know, didn't allow us to be very bold and courageous or very crazy. Those ideas were shut down in sense.
I feel like in all the senses, it's shut down.
And because perhaps it's the priority of the also the country, you know, the kind of spaces, the economy we live in, maybe we need to be more realistic. But when I went to Barcelona, we had people from Germany, Austria, people from Spain and America and Latin America, and they had all such bold ideas. You know, there was such a beautiful cultural exchange and exchange of intellect without any boundaries that all the preconceived notion or definitions I had were redefined. I wouldn't say they were broken down. They were redefined, you know. That's when my interest in research and experimentation grew much stronger.
So the redefinition led to your profession right now.
Yes.
So what year did you go for your master's in?
In 2015, I did my master in, it's called the Master's in Advanced Architecture.
Okay.
And I specialized in this course called Digital Matter, which is all about using intelligence of materials and embedding that into technology to create smart futures. And of course, one thing led to another. We started with a simple course of understanding how materials respond to external stimuli like heat and sound and, you know, pressure and observing how their shape changes. You know, everything in nature is materials and they are very sort of organic. You know? So these forms that we took from our observations were the building block of our design. And so that's when one of my first definition of architecture should be orthogonal, you know, sharp corners, rectangular blocks was broken. And I was very comfortable using fluid shapes. Before then, I didn't have a purpose as to why a fluid shape.
In architecture school, I was always the one working with geometric shapes and not a circle being one of the geometric shapes. Because I never really understood it. Because I feel like every form needs to come from a process.
Yes.
And I feel like you arrive at any form, it should be answering questions of what, why, where, and how.
So it's difficult for us to mimic these fluid shapes is because unlike nature, we deposit and build, but nature grows and builds, you know. So the material understands what kind of geometry it needs to aggregate or, you know, grow into. That's why biomimicry becomes so difficult as coming up with spheres and fluid shapes and making cast for, you know, depositing these becomes a very top-down approach and a difficult approach for construction industry. So I think one of the answers is to look at how the nature is depositing these materials, how it is growing cells. So one of the In one of the papers I was writing, I did some reading where I understood that the bamboo, which we have, it has this linear form with segments called nodes, right? So if you zoom in into the nanoscale of bamboo, these cells of bamboo also have a similar structure, which means nature multiplies its smallest form. And that's why they say, you know, form in nature is very cheap, but material is expensive because it has to eat and then grow. Unlike in architecture, where materials are cheap and form becomes expensive.
So
we need to find ways to, you know, balance those differences.
So, Shiz, what is material research and why is it so important?
Right. So everything around us is made up of matter.
Yeah.
And today we live in this world of, which is a linear system. We live in the world where we take from the earth, we make, we use, and we dispose. You know, in the process, we create a lot of landfills and waste, and waste which degrades or emits toxic substances and disrupts the ecosystem. Hence, we need to look at what happens at what happens to a building and the life of it, you know, of its use, and design a model where materials don't lose their value. Today we create waste is because we don't have value for the waste, you know, but waste is a resource.
Yes.
A plastic bottle is a resource to make another plastic bottle or a toothbrush or even a concrete building is nothing but a resource to possibly find new ways of using that material to construct new. So we, you know, reduce the pressure of extraction from the earth. So it really goes into that because these materials take thousands and millions of years to be born again.
Yes, you know,
petroleum, which is used to make plastic, takes millions of years. So it's only wise for us to be more sensitive about our material choices. And material choices are, it's not an independent choice. It has to be linked with the design. It has to be linked with the culture, with the technology, you know, allowed or available in the market that we are. So it's kind of a network of decisions that we take, of course, through the lens of what the physical matter is and wants to be, to make it more meaningful.
So do you think right now material research as a field, as a profession, is detached from, it's separate from the implementation environment or team or something like that? Do you think that exists?
It's not detached. It's just not perhaps growing as fast as our problems are. You know,
It's not like integrated as well as it should be.
Right. It's not advancing enough. You know, like you said, integration is important because our problems are constantly changing every year. And then we are still using the same kind of interior finishes, the similar kind of concrete and, you know, reinforcements or even, you know, partitions and everything that we do. That model hasn't refreshed in the long time.
I feel like we do that because it's easy.
It's absolutely.
Yeah.
Because it's expensive to innovate in two materials.
Yeah.
And again, so when we innovate in materials, we create a new system of manufacturing, which means a lot of investments.
Yes.
When there's a new system of manufacturing, there really or possibly is a new system of assembling them together, which means our labor needs to be retrained.
Yes.
It's a difficult journey to develop a material and make it standardized. So what we can do is, the best is if we have standard materials available right now in the market, we can at least look at assemblies which don't create a waste, you know, look at buildings that can be dismantled. So it's easy for us to, you know, create or close that loop, basically.
I understand exactly what you're saying, because this time last year I was working in some village in Uttarakhand and we were trying to introduce CSEB to them. Because a red brick, when it reaches there, it costs about 12 to 15 rupees.
Yes.
So they cannot, you know, rebuild. And the only thing they're dependent on is government housing and whatever schemes come from the city. So we actually were trying to set up like this manual machine. And we were trying to teach them that, okay, this is how an earth block is made. And whatever you just said, it actually happened. Like, I've experienced that. That first is, at any point in time when you introduce a new material, the first reaction is, wow, ye kya hai? They like, they play around and they toy around with it. And then the second thing is breaking the trust issue. You have to have a material that's solid enough, especially when you're using it for building construction, that if someone picks it up and really throws it and bangs it on the wall or bangs it on the floor, it shouldn't like break into half. So that's the second thing they did. They picked it up, picked the brick up, and they like banged it on the floor and like, ye nahi toot rahi hai, ye achhi hai. I was like, ye achhi hai. Then you have to tell them. I feel like telling them what is in the material should come like last. Because the minute you tell them ki ye mitti ki bani hai, you've like lost.
We have a lot of assumptions about these materials.
I was part of a team where I was seeing myself having conversations with people that convincing them that, listen, it will not break. And you have to trust it. He's like, yahan pe barish bahut hoti hai. Ye to mitti ka bana hai, to bhur jayega. I was like, no, ye nahi bhurega. Iske andar cement bhi hai saath mein. Also, I feel like something as simple as teaching them or re-teaching them how to use cement and make concrete was again like a really big challenge. Because I feel like there was like a solid divide between men and women. And the solid divide was educated, non-educated.
Okay.
Educated in the sense that, actually not even educated, skilled. Skilled and unskilled.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of women that don't know how to make buildings.
Mm-hmm.
So they took to it much faster. They learned the process.
Okay, interesting.
They analyzed it.
Mm-hmm.
There was like a huge sense of analysis happening because mm-hmm. they're constantly comparing it with the brick. Even though so many of the women, there were 70 women I was working with, and only about like 5 had worked or even picked up a brick before. So
right.
that was amazing. I feel like that's why I mentioned that, you know, in architecture education, I feel like when you're at a very impressionable stage, industry outside selling, you know, normal material is aggressive as it is. It's
Absolutely.
Not like they're stepping back. So do you think that if material research gets enough backing from mm-hmm. the big players,
yeah.
do you think that would help?
Yes, definitely. Because, I mean, the backing is not necessarily about the funding that we get. Of course, that's required. But when a big player is placing trust, you know, smaller industries can have more faith in the possibility of what
they
can happen.
They just follow, I think.
Yeah, they just follow.
They follow.
You know, it's as simple as that. Please about the
Indian
school, some of them focus on digital fabrication.
Yes.
Some of them focus
yeah.
on interior experience. Some purely focus on crazy forms.
Yes.
We just need to understand that all these little factors are equally important. And it becomes a challenge to compress the intellect of these different domains into 5 years. But there is a possibility, you know, to relook at what are the gaps in existing curriculum.
Yeah. I feel like it needs to be updated.
Yes, yes. But private schools are doing that. They have been revisiting their curriculum. Maybe government curriculum is kind of similar, but I'm nobody right now to comment. Like I said, it's easy to, you know, step out of it and But yes, what we need to do is get together, you know, private schools, public schools, all kinds of different faculty from different domains
yeah.
need to come together and see if we can not deliver a model, the same model in all schools,
yeah.
but at least consciously identify, hey, you guys, you'll be consciously focusing on these areas.
Yeah.
We will be focusing on these areas.
Yeah. Any architecture school, like any private
mm-hmm.
school, I feel like their interest is nowhere close to becoming, you know, sustainable
mm-hmm.
or, I mean, that is not the focus. That will
mm-hmm.
definitely be in the curriculum.
Yeah.
And they will consider it, but I feel like it's nowhere their main core
mm-hmm.
interest.
Mm-hmm.
So I just feel like that conversation is
no, but it's happening, I would say.
Like, it's happening,
but I think we are run down by the population. You know, we are
mm-hmm.
so many of us. So even if 50 schools are participating,
mm-hmm.
We have, I mean, the proportions don't match, you know,
yeah.
for the number of schools we actually have and
mm.
for the schools which are working together, sustainable.
So how do you think that bridge can be gapped?
Mm-hmm.
Knowing that there are so many material researchers and there are so
mm-hmm.
and so private schools who are
mm-hmm.
working towards building and research and
mm.
working on sustainability.
Hmm.
Hardcore. Okay, you know, it's a very specific profession. Like,
hmm.
I will become a researcher.
The research by making is kind of new.
Yeah.
Where you investigate and then you create something, you know, with your hands, with the tools that you have.
Hmm.
That's
hmm.
relatively new.
Hmm.
Of course, as a country, we are a maker's country.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
From our history.
Yes.
It's just that we didn't realize that there's so much capacity of that ancient model even in the newer education.
Yeah.
When schools like IAC started doing that, you
yeah.
know, calling it digital fabrication, material
yeah.
science,
yeah.
It picked up larger pace.
Hmm.
For the entire world, maker culture is still new. For India, it is not. You know,
yeah.
So we just need to be, we need to value that more,
hmm.
you know, of what we already own as a knowledge.
Hmm. So Shreyas, how did architecture school help you?
It helped me redefine definitions, like I said.
Hmm.
You know, the first course, which this is in a master program
okay.
at IAC. The one of the first courses that changed my perception was with Edward Cabet, where we had to subject materials to certain situations and observe
yeah.
from their forms.
Yeah.
Somewhere in that course, I sort of increased my liking towards this approach of investigating. And hence, after that, every decision that I took, you know, we had a lot of electives and courses to choose from. Every course I took were towards engineering, materials, fabrication. And at the end of the master, we worked on this project called the self-adaptive membrane. That was a research-based material where we designed buildings that can deploy. you know, using a smart material called nitinol. So it's a shape memory alloy that can, like the name says, it remembers a shape. So at a certain degree Celsius, if the environment is too extreme, then it can activate the space and make it more responsive to the current needs, like control temperatures, control the amount of heat gain and shading, etc. So at the end of this master, my life had changed so much that there was no scope for me to come back to India and work in a, you know, say design studio and do similar practice which I did before my master. So that's the reason I joined education. That's when I wanted to take some workshops, share my knowledge. You know, I started with just these workshops on making small robots with waste cardboard or using flexible fabric and making all kinds of organic forms, which can be product, can be garment, can be spaces. And from that point onwards, you know, the school helped me, had faith in me, you know, in that case, to give me the platform to start these workshops. And it just grew from then. I climbed up the ladder. I mean, the ladder of my intellect, I would say, not positions, but
which is what matters.
Yeah, which is what matters.
Yeah. But tell me more about this material. Did you work with it like real time?
The green charcoal? The shape memory alloy. No, we purchased shape memory alloys.
It's available in the market.
It's available in the market. It's relatively cheap. It's a small material that has a very high strength in its activated form, you know.
So how does it get activated?
With heat. So if you heat the shape memory alloy to, say, 60 degrees Celsius, every material, every shape memory alloy has different activation temperature depending on the composition, different shapes. And say, for example, if we have a spring in a dead state or in a sort of a cold state, it can be deformed to create any shape like a star, or you can make it into a U-pin. But the moment it reaches 60 degrees Celsius, it will take the shape it's programmed to be. So we capitalize on this property to create a kinetic passive joint, a joint which can, which when embedded into a system of assembly, like a system of say structure, this linear motion which the joint creates can activate or deploy the 3D geometry, you know, 3D form of space. So we looked at, in an extremely hot day, the spring gets activated and it could possibly naturally cover the facade of the building. You know, or if it's a single person tent, it can deploy when you go to deserts and you carry your folded structures on your back. So those were the ideas. And we made a physical 1 meter by 1 meter model to prove the concept. And it did get published on ARC2O and a couple of other online magazines, including a platform for material research by Manuel Kritzer. It's called Materiability. He also published our work on his knowledge platform. So, that was good validation.
Of course. Yes. I have so many more questions about this material, but I'm not going to ask it right now. I'll ask you like later.
As most of our listeners know, we've been running a Keto crowdfunding campaign to raise funds and capital to produce season 2. We'd like to take a few seconds to thank all our contributors to help us raise enough capital to be able to produce season 2.
Could you recall the time when you consciously decided to move away from core architecture?
When I came back, like I said, know, that there was no scope for me to join a conventional design company, which is fair. I mean, they're doing great in their own place. But since I had invested so much money and time and effort, I might as well, I thought I would rather continue that trajectory. So it was a conscious decision. It was a risk that I took, you know. Again, back then, it was pure interest, area of interest that I wanted to pursue. So it just happened somehow. I think somehow the universe helped me in the way. I didn't really know what I was getting into when I took the master. I didn't really know what I was getting into when I took architecture. Everything just fell in the right place.
So when you consciously decide to move away from architecture, did you tell someone or did you have a talk with some advisor or a mentor and say that, you know, hey, I mean, I did 5 years of architecture. Now I don't want to do core architecture. and I've studied this for like another 2-3 years, master's, and I want to move away from core architecture. Mm-hmm. Like, did you have that conversation with a mentor or something?
No. Somewhere? Back then, I was my own advisor. I would just contemplate and take that risk. Yeah.
So what were the fears when you took that risk of changing professions?
The fear was that the commercial sector or the industry that we practice in India is very different. It became a lot of struggle. You know, most of these researches, they get restricted to a studio level environment.
Yes.
And we don't really get to see the opportunity of creating a live project. It can happen, but it's a longer journey. It's a more difficult road to take.
Yes.
And that was my biggest fear, is how practical is this going to be, considering our standing, into research. Because honestly, I didn't really consult anyone to what to do. You know, should I join back a regular office or a design office in architecture?
Did you not do like a teacher or a professor?
I didn't ask anybody. I just found that there's a school. One of my ex-colleagues told me that there's a new school set up in Mumbai. I saw their profile. I thought this could be a place to enter and make some changes. Not changes in the school, but in the entire discipline as such.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just took that. I took a leap of faith, you know.
Which is important also. So how did you decide to go for your master's?
When I saw the works, what IAC was doing,
it
was very emerging. All the ideas were new. All the ideas were experimental and something which I thought I would learn a lot by, going there. Something which we haven't even touched or spoken about in the undergrad.
Mm.
So that was a simple intuitive call that I took. And of course, it's Spain.
So I got through
a couple of other universities in London, in Singapore. This one was offering amazing education with an amazing life.
So you decided to go.
Yes.
So you had like, in terms of expectation, because I feel like after we graduate, there's a common period of 5 plus 2 years.
5 plus 2, yes.
Plus 2 years where in those 2 years, you either decide to go for a master's or you decide to continue or you change your job or you start your own work. Like any of these three things can happen.
Yes.
And I feel like the thinking behind whatever choice you make is different for everyone. So what was your thinking right after you graduated? Did you have a plan of action or did you?
I wanted to work. Yes, those 5 plus 2 which you mentioned, they were very instrumental in taking this call of doing master's, because both the companies I worked in, they put me on, important roles. I was the lead project architect, designing institutional projects and architecture gymnasium standalone. I was working on large-scale construction projects where I had a lot of responsibilities, So when I saw the principal architects placing trust in me, I think I thought of myself. I looked at myself with more respect back then. It made me more confident as a designer. And then I felt I reached the peak. In 2 years, I felt that, I've done conceptual designing, I've done working drawings, I've done a lot of physical modeling. I have checked all the boxes. I've also had meetings with consultants, understood how the real construction happens, including site visits. I thought this is the time for me to now, go to Europe and be amongst them, Because their education is very advanced. So you have to work in India for a couple of years to kind of
put yourself up to that level.
Absolutely.
Of cognition.
Absolutely.
Just given the choice, would you go back to architecture school or would you do something different?
I am in a school right now. The perks of teaching is that you get to be a student and you get to be an educator. I don't call myself a teacher, it's because the model of teacher is basically a person who delivers knowledge and student becomes a person who receives knowledge. But
I would say impact. it's not a client.
But that's conventional, no? I see we are all educators and we mainly have a dialogue talk with students. They bring a lot of insights. We bring a lot of insights from our end, and we create something new together. So the fact that I'm teaching in a school right now as a researcher and educator doesn't make me feel that I'm very far from being a student myself. And especially when you design your own curriculum, there's a lot of homework. There's a lot of lesson planning to be done. How are you going to, what kind of conversations are you going to have with the students? What questions are you going to propose to them, you know, so they can start thinking. So it's mainly about right questioning as against giving the right answers, you know. So I don't feel I'm very far from being a student myself.
So Shaz, what were the one or two landmark points in your career as a researcher that gave you the confidence that you needed as a skilled individual?
Right. So I've been working on this ongoing research called The Green Charcoal. You must have seen some of the publications.
Yes,
It's been on for the last 2 years almost, where I was developing, you know, materials and understanding properties, looking at concrete and making it more natural. But somewhere in the journey, this event called the Fab Biennale came into place, the future of architecture and building, and we got invited. So Meenal and I got very excited about this, and and because there was an external you know, benchmark, we had to up our game. We had to build a team. We were working day in, day out, 24 hours sometimes. But then we also had a lot of students who were, you know, working on this. So because there was an external deadline, we speeded up our material trajectory, developed more conclusive models, which can be performative. So our whole goal was to create concrete that can allow growth of biodiversity, not just growing plants, but allow also insects and microbes to grow. You know, because the problem of today's cities is that we are vanishing all the trees. Problem of agriculture is that we are planting only single type of crop. So when we do that, there's no biodiversity that is, you know, growing. So we looked at how cities can be, you know, by sort of biodegradable at, at one point, and also allow growth of different species together. So when this Fab Biennale came into place, we made more conclusive models, more larger models, more performative, that we say. And we exhibited this entire research along with the ethos of material library, which we have in ISTI, at the exhibition. And the guests were from, I mean, we had one of the best pioneers, leading pioneers in architecture, like Dr. David Benjamin, Dr. Philip Block from Block Research Group, Alison Ring from Elegant Embellishments. They were surprised and they were pleasantly happy about, you know, the research that we are doing. So that gave us a great validation again, that what we are doing is not very off from what the world requires or needs, you know. So when that happened, I think our confidence level boost, you know, kind of grew up. We had we started having conversations with industry, you know, from that point onwards. Of course, the kind of questions we received were very technical in the Biennale, that how expensive is this material, you know? And when you develop something new, you're not very sure about the cost. You're not very sure how it's going to last long. You know, it's literally some of our materials are just 6 months old. So we don't know if they're going to, you know, be enough.
They haven't stood the test of time.
They haven't stood the test of time. But at least the fact that we got invited to write on our research and we got validated and appreciated gave us the confidence that, yes, the material innovation is in the right, you know, place and direction.
Yeah, I think that's great.
Yeah.
So could you walk us through the different steps of research?
So the first definitely initiates with a secondary study. It's understanding the existing practices, understanding, you know, what happens in the past, what happened because of industrialization, you know, where everything became a standard commodity, to realizing what are the problems of societies today. And connecting those dots, you know, like they say, finding the research gap. So the research gap which we found was to develop materials that can allow biodiversity.
Uh-huh.
You know, a lot of materials do allow growth of plants on them.
But
are they equally biodegradable?
Yeah.
Are they also going to match to the expectations of the industry?
Yeah.
So the initial phase was all about doing research,
understanding,
putting our picture together, you know, like a mind map that they say.
Yeah.
And then literally starting with kitchen experiments, taking materials, creating new composition, scientifically studying them, weighing them, measuring their volumes, amount of water that you put in, and allowing materials to speak with you. That's very important.
Okay.
You know, you don't just make materials. You observe what they're doing, how they're behaving. And you, when you make next batch of, you know, prototypes, you do them based on learnings of the other and what the earlier models have to say. Some of them, if they crack in a certain manner, if they, you know, melt or if they degenerate, there's a scientific reason, you know, based in the chemical composition or physical composition. So learning from that, one has to develop, you know, smarter and smarter materials. And then eventually when the material, at this stage, the materials are still swatches. They are maybe in a petri dish, they're into a rectangular block, basic forms. Once you get a promising result, you then start giving them more defined geometries.
And you scale it up.
And you scale it. And then you test for the performance.
Yeah. So when does the cost factor come in?
Cost factor comes in, I think, when, I would say, when we have scientific labs, you know, doing some tests on them. Right now, these tests are still limited to a studio and the equipments that you know, we have. But these are not manufacturing or scientific labs with test tubes and, you know, big industry equipment. So when they come into picture, clarity and more scientific numbers can be sort of churned out of materials. And that's when you understand the life. Of course, we can estimate a trajectory based on the way they have been performing for last 6 months. But again, it's experience, intuition, and a lot of guesswork at this time. Not in a bad way, but that's the way forward.
So when you're creating a new material, how do you decide where you start? I mean, it's like a whole world of materials.
So it really it's based on your research question. You know,
how do you arrive at your research question?
It's a secondary research, you know, finding the gap.
Ah.
So you have to really trace your footsteps back and ask yourself what you want to do. What is the objective of this research? Are you going to change the economic structure of materials? Are you going to change the assembly model of materials? Or are you going to develop a new material? When these areas are sort of, you know, defined, it leads you on, you know. There's no one formula. There's no set formula at all. It just grows. What I was trying to achieve 2 years now or two years ago is was completely different. The clarity, the detail, the objectives have all evolved and changed.
So, Shiz, how would you define failure?
So, failure is basically just a learning curve. You know, in the research, it's very important to fail fast so you can learn faster. Initially, I was a little more resistant or more afraid of failures when the research began. In master, you always have your faculty. You know, you are a student. So it's easy to fail in a course or an academics. But when the research was started by me, initiated by myself, failing was more scary to face, you know. But I've learned that the best way to move forward in research is fast failures, learning from mistakes. And that's what I tell my students as well, you know, in classroom, that bring all the physical failures that you'll have had, you know, in your material innovation or even system innovation. Because there's so many answers and cues, you know, to pull out from there.
So I feel like this resistance to failure, like you just said, I think it's so strongly ingrained in us.
Yes. Right.
That, you know, failing is synonymous with, you know, something bad.
Yeah, there's so much pressure on pleasing.
Yes.
You know,
yes,
but not really, there's no understanding of the failures are the answers.
Yeah.
You know, one of the biggest, most successful people or original thinkers are the ones who tried the most, and that's why they failed the most. And, you know, from the 100 attempts, two or three are those which are game-changing or revolutionary. So failure is a must, you know, important process to go through.
So how do you explain this to your students? How do you make that psychological shift? Because I feel like when you're coming out of school, you're coming with a very strong mental image of failure as a concept. And when you come to any design school or architecture school or even research, I feel like that mold breaks. Mm-hmm. So as someone who is imparting mm-hmm. knowledge, how mm-hmm. do you break that?
I don't use the word failure in my classroom in that sense, you know. Even if I do, I show my utmost excitement in those models.
Mm-hmm.
So I know, I've seen these reactions that when I get excited about some, models that are not working out, I start, learning and observing them.
Mm-hmm.
And when I do that and I see potential and talk about the, sort of further possibilities with this, the students are that much more encouraged to look at the positive side as against, cry about the negative or be worried about what didn't work out.
Mm.
So I just try to make the environment or classroom more positive space for them. It's like creating a, forming a relationship of trust. I think that's very important.
Yeah.
So the failure just disappears.
That's a very nice way of looking at it.
Yeah.
So is material research the only way to design a sustainable future?
Mm-hmm. Hmm. So, yeah, when we design new materials, it takes at least 5 to 10 years for them to be, for them to be more commercially ready.
Mm-hmm.
You may be able to build a full-scale pavilion in 2-3 years,
hmm.
but you will still not be able to build a functional housing building or an office space, in that span of time.
Yeah.
So it takes 10 years easy to standardize and commercialize a material.
Okay.
What we are looking at right now is, along with this whole domain of developing biocultured materials or degradable materials, we are looking at systemic changes, is where we can take existing finishes, concrete, existing materials that are available, be it wooden flooring, be it vitrified tiling, or be it gypsum boards and partition walls. If we innovate in systems of assembling them, for easy transportation, for easy sort of putting together, and also keeping in mind the ease of dismantling, because when they get dismantled efficiently, the different components of your composite, like a partition wall, will have some metal framework, wooden infills, you'll have battens and ply and even paint. So if these components can be separated out, it can be easy for them to be recycled. The challenges of today is that most of the materials that we made are composite. Separating them becomes difficult, and because separating is so cost intensive, companies don't want to recycle them.
Oh.
So the assembly or systemic changes is one of the second leg of the research ethos we have in ISDE.
Uh-huh.
And together these lead to creating a circular economy where materials don't end up into landfill.
Yeah.
They just are trapped into a cycle where they are used again for third life, fourth life, fifth life, and sixth life, and so on.
So what would be one example of this kind of a material?
One example would be something I'm quoting from Ellen MacArthur Foundation. They are working on circular economy. And so if you look at our construction, our buildings, we have concrete reinforced with metal. Now, this is the best quality concrete, best quality reinforcement to create a healthy environment, long-lasting building. If we tear it down, if we design for easy tear down, we can get the reinforcement separately, and we can get the concrete separately, and we can get the tiling separately. So when these three materials are separated out, they can go into second life. So concrete, or high quality concrete, after recycling can become concrete good for making roads. Recycling roads can give you concrete good enough to make paver blocks. Or recycling paver blocks can give you concrete that's good enough for any pressure or substructural use where engineering is not an important component. So that's how we can that's how we can valorize our materials and keep them trapped in a circular system and not creating any waste and taking them to landfills.
So don't you think that in this process there has to be equal care given to
care given to assembly and also the responsibility of user.
Yes.
So one of the things which is so important
but also the responsibility of when you're taking it out, because I feel like a lot of times when people are breaking it, the labor who's breaking it, they don't care.
Because they're not designed for a certain manner as well.
Yeah.
There's no particular definition of how to even remove a tile when it's stuck with concrete. You just have to break it down.
It just breaks off completely.
Right. But something very important you spoke of is, the care to be taken. Care to be taken while assembling. Most importantly, care to be care to be taken while disassembling, but most important is the care to be taken by user. If we maintain our products, if we maintain our spaces well, we increase their life, you know. So there's something called the emotional durability of design, is where we value what we have and we don't just chuck things out. You know, so you're forced to use a plastic bottle or even a ceramic cup or even your curtains in your house for a longer period, you know, with a regular wash and regular care. So they don't degrade faster than they should be. So I think users are equally important in, you know, changing or taking control of this cycle.
So how do you think the whole concept of use and throw, that's I think primarily coming from the Western world, how does that adapting to it, and how do you think that can change in our country?
So if we see 10 years or 15 years from now, we didn't have this culture, you know. India, we inherently were not
we don't follow that
culture.
We used
to repair everything.
Everything is fixable.
Absolutely.
Everything is either degradable, organic, or it can be fixed.
And
be reused.
You go on the streets and you'll find so many electricians and mechanics servicing, fitting, and, you know, sort of giving a new life to existing damaged electronics. It's just that it's sad that we are following this consumerism model where it's become easy to throw something out. So we just need to be sensitive and not do that, you know. But at the same time, we also need to revive those skills. We do see lesser number of people who can repair your, you know,
shoes.
AC shafts, AC, your shoes or anything like so if we get that model of repairing, we are going to make it that much easy, you know, for us to maintain or maintain the value of materials that we have around. And of course, by saying that, I mean maintain the value of products and spaces.
But I feel like it's very difficult to avoid consumerism because it's traveling so fast and with such a great intensity.
It's very lucrative.
It's super intense, super lucrative, and it's so attractive and shiny that everyone just, you know, they just want to get get their hands on it, you know, and be like, be a part of this movement.
You just need more people working on this, I guess.
Now, Shreyas, we come to a section of the podcast, which is a new section. We call it Listeners' Questions. So on Instagram, we invited our listeners to ask questions to potential guests, and you were one of them. So we have two people writing in. One is, one question is by Urban Shastri. So they ask, what is the importance of structure and building material in architecture school?
In architecture school, I think what happens is the structure and material are seen as independent bodies. What we need to just do is change that mindset, change the approach of engineering being a result of materials. You know, space being a result of what materials want to be and what the user wants to live in. So when we dissolve these boundaries, we create a new sort of more integrated model. Like I mentioned earlier, that in nature, materials deposit themselves and arrange themselves to create a form. They are not forced to fit into a shape. You know, so if we follow similar models, I think
we should be good.
Yeah, we should be good.
Great. The second question comes from Vasudha Karnani. She asks, how did you realize your interest in material technology, and what was your journey in education after that?
Very important. You know, to be a student in most unique courses is very important because you meet a lot of people from different countries, different mindsets, different cultures, experiences. And these conversations are the ones which guide you. You know, you may not have one mentor or one person who changed your life, but it's a collection of these conversations. And if you have the capacity to reflect on them, then you are good to be on your own in a way.
So thank you all for listening in today. This was an incredible conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It was my pleasure.
And I think we can keep talking for another 2-3 hours. I mean, I would love to. And you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. Our handle is at Good for Construction Podcast. And please follow our content and subscribe to our channel on a bunch of platforms, that is iTunes, Apple Podcasts. We are on Stitcher, we're on Spotify, we're on Google Podcasts. So you can download any of these applications, subscribe to our channel, so that every Friday when a new episode is released, you can be notified. So thank you all for listening. We will see you next Friday. Bye-bye.